Good morning, everybody. We are in lesson number 14 of the book of Mark. We are going to finish out chapter 10. I get tickled every time I want to say this is a really, really important passage. And it really is a really, really important passage because this is the ending of a section that began back right after the beginning of chapter 8. And it's going to end with the last healing that we see today. It'll be the last time Jesus heals anyone during his ministry. When we pick up in chapter 11 next week, we'll be starting in with his Passion Week, and it'll be the triumphal entry. So this is ending the last time. Jesus has got all these teachings that he's been trying to do from the moment that he does a healing just before Peter's great confession, to the Mount of Transfiguration, to multiple healings and issues and problems. The apostles are just struggling. They just don't get it. Remember, at one point Jesus says to them, and we said we think it's him talking to the apostles. He says, "How long will I put up with you? You just don't believe." And you know what he's thinking is, he says, "I don't have much more time. You've got to get this." And we're going to see the last two sections that he talks about today in chapter 10. He's going to end this period of teaching going from the area of the Sea of Galilee all the way down to Jerusalem, and he's ready to go in and enter. So it's exciting. It's kind of an interesting thing. If you are a Christian, as we all profess to be, this is the beginning of the event that brings us salvation. It's the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that's what he is so desperately trying to get his apostles to understand. So let's just pick back up and see where we go. Chapter 10, starting in verse 32. They were on their way to Jerusalem. Remember, we've been up in Caesarea Philippi. We've been at the Sea of Galilee. We've now gone all the way down. We were just at the Jordan in the early part of chapter 10. And it says, they're on their way to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. I want to get you the idea as he's out in front. They are following behind him. One of the phrases you'll hear people talk about sometime is when you're a disciple of someone, you're covered in their dust. And it's the idea that you're so close behind him that as he walks along the way, the dust off of his feet come up and hit you and it's on you. Or it's also a possibility that you sit at the feet in the dust of your master sitting in the chair and teaching you. Jesus is leading the way. He has a focus. He has a purpose. He's heading to Jerusalem. He knows what that means, and he's trying to make sure everybody else does as well. And the disciples were astonished. And then we've said this before, that when they see the word, and we see the word astonished, that's not a surprise. Oh, wow, that was something wonderful. I'm astonished at that. It's no, they don't understand. They don't get it. Another word that's used is right after it says, while those who followed were afraid. Now, you can debate back and forth whether they're talking about a large group of people and the apostles were astonished and the other people were afraid. Some of the commentators that I read said that really he's talking about the apostles, and they have both this anxiety and astonishment and this fear at the same time. They've heard him say the things about going to die. They don't get it. It doesn't resonate with them. And we're going to see it again here in just a second. But when it says, again, he took the 12 aside, it's kind of the idea, he called them around them. They're all walking along the way, and there's probably more people than just his 12 apostles. But it's not a whole lot more. It's not a huge crowd like sometimes follow him. But he pulls them aside, and he stops this focused march that he has to Jerusalem, and he says, I got to tell you what's going to happen to me. Three times now we've seen that Jesus has tried desperately to explain to them. More than that, he's used phrases that imply that he's going to die, and he's talked about resurrection from the dead. But three times in chapters 8, 9, and 10, and one thing, if maybe you can remember this, I don't know if you like little catchphrases, but it's at 8:30, it's at 9:30, and it's at 10:30. That he does these things. In chapter 8, it's verse 31. In chapter 9, it's verse 31. And in chapter 10, it's verses 33 through 34. So if you can kind of think of a time of day, 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, the book of Mark, Jesus is going to explain very clearly when he is how he's going to die. I want to look at all three of those things real quick. In 8:31, the first time he says it, it talked about the fact that he's just heard Peter's great confession. And so he says, he speaks plainly to them. And he says, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. And after 3 days, he would rise again. What happened with that? Peter takes him aside and said, nope, Lord, that's not going to be that way. You don't understand. It's not going to happen the way you're saying. To which Peter turns his back on him and says, get behind me, Satan. You don't know what you're talking about. The second time in chapter 9, Jesus says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days, he will rise again. Now, right after this time, they're on their way again, and the apostles are arguing about who's going to be greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus takes them aside and says, you completely don't understand. The one who is last is the one who's going to be first, and the one who is first is going to be last, and you've got to understand this. And we talked about little children and things like that. Now, this time, we have just finished his discourse on divorce and on money, talking about the rich young ruler. And we talked about how Jesus was very focused on the fact that this is what God wants. It's what God wants. And you've got to think about that. But he's not doing that saying, oh, guess what? You've got to follow more rules. They're not getting the rules. He says, you got to follow me. You've got to follow me. So one more time, he says now, starting in chapter 10, verse 33, he says, the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and to the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him, kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. So he has gotten progressively more detailed. This time he adds something that's brand new, and that is that he will be tried. Condemned is something that happens after you are tried. They don't just kill him because they're mad at him and take him out and murder him. They try him in a court, kangaroo court, albeit, but a court nonetheless, and they condemn him, and they can't kill him, so they turn him over to the Gentiles. Jesus is very clearly prophesying what is about to happen to him, literally, in the next few days. And he is very, very specific. He says they're going to mock him, and spit on him, and flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. That's the way this ends. Three times in a very short period of time. We don't know exactly how long, but probably no more than a month or so. It took him time to get from up in Caesarea Philippi, north of the Sea of Galilee, all the way down to Jericho, Jordan, and then to Jerusalem. So it's been in fairly short order. He's been saying this to them. Probably said it more than that. These are just the ones that Mark records for us. So anyway, let's see how they follow it. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Now, what kind of a request is that? Your kids do that to you sometimes, don't they? Daddy, 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 granddaddy, granddaddy, granddaddy. I'm going to ask you something, and you've got to do whatever I ask. Tell me right now, you got to do whatever I ask. You know you're being set up whenever that happens. You know it's something you're not really typically going to want to do. But sometimes you just say, okay, what is it? And you do it anyway. Maybe it's taking them to get ice cream, or maybe it's buying them some toy that they want or whatever. Jesus has just explained something that is so intensely personal to him. I am going to be tried and convicted and humiliated and persecuted and killed. And then I'm going to rise. And instead of them going, what do you mean by this rising part? What do you mean by this humiliation? We don't understand it. Explain that to us in more detail. Instead of saying that, what do they do? A little while later, they're going, hey, we got a favor to ask of you. Jesus, just tell us. You've got to say yes. Okay, you're going to say yes to this, right? Because we got something to ask you. And what does Jesus do? He says, what do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. They know Jesus is going to be glorified. They think it's going to be because as the Messiah, which they have acknowledged, and Jesus has accepted, and Jesus has explained to them all sorts of stuff about him being the Son of Man, and we've talked about that being the Daniel 7 prophecy, and how important that was in prophecy. He is the Messiah. He is the promised one. He's the anointed one of God. They know he's going to be in glory, and they want to be on that left and right hand seats. That's what they want. He says, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. Jesus says, you don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Now let's stop for a second and talk briefly about this cup and this baptism. Three passages we'll look at. There's a bunch of passages in the Old Testament specifically talking about the cup, and it is the wrath of God. Remember when Jesus says in the garden, I take this cup from me, but I'll take it if I need to take it? And the Father's looking at him, and they're kind of having this conversation. We only hear Jesus as part of it. But anyway, Jesus says, I don't want to do this. It's getting closer, and the more I think about it, the less I like the idea of it. But in the end, in my belief, and we won't talk about why right now, but in my belief, Jesus came to the conclusion, I will do what the Father wants me to do. I don't think the Father is making him. I don't think the Father actually ever makes us do anything. He gives us all the power. He gives us all the understanding. He gives us the Holy Spirit. He gives us education. He gives us examples from our friends and our teachers. He gives us the Bible. He gives us all sorts of things for us to come to the conclusion. Why is that? Because it's coming to that conclusion that demonstrates faith. You see, if I don't come to that conclusion, then God's just making me do stuff. And he doesn't want us to do stuff. He wants us to trust him. He wants us to trust that he will do in us the things that he wants us to do if we will simply let him. So anyway, let's look at this cup of wrath in the Old Testament. In Psalm 75, in the hand of the Lord is a cup full of foaming wine mixed with spices. He, talking about the Lord, pours it out, and all the wicked of the earth drink it down to the very dregs. The wicked of the earth drink this cup. Second from Isaiah, awake, awake, rise up, Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who you who have drained to its dregs the goblet that makes people stagger. Again, wrath, the cup of wrath. And finally, from Isaiah again, in chapter 51, awake, awake, rise up, Jerusalem. You know what? I'm looking at that right here, and I left the wrong thing on there. We're going to stop. I had a third passage, but I don't remember what it is, and I'm standing here without a Bible in front of me. So we're just going to skip and go with those two. If you want some more passages, let me know. That's my mistake. But anyway, you see what he's talking about. It is a wrath. It's the wrath of God that is the cup of wrath represents. Now, what about baptism? Baptism is not used as a reference. It doesn't actually talk about baptism per se in the Old Testament. There are some references to what we call baptism, the mikvah, in what the Levites were supposed to do, the priests were supposed to do when they were serving in the temple. But that's not this. Let's look at a few passages here, see if I've got all of these right. Psalm 69, verse 2, I will sink in the miry depths where there is no foothold. I have come into the deep waters. The floods engulf me. Many, many times in Scripture it talks about the waters overcoming me. Remember in the creation story, there is this water represents wild and waste. That's what water represents to them. That's what the deep represents to them. So baptism is being in that deep and being engulfed in it. Second verse, Isaiah 43. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. This is saying that you can be protected from that engulfing by the waters. And finally, in Jonah, you might expect to be a passage in Jonah, you hurled me into the depths, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounds me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. Not a good thing. See, the idea of baptism at this point, when Jesus is talking about, can you be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? He's talking about, can you survive being swirled in the water and coming up out of it? You know, do you think we'd get a little more significance out of baptism if we thought that we were being put down into a torrent like that? That we're being immersed into a wild and waste water. And why is it so important? Because that's where you die. That water engulfs you. That's why it's so scary, because you're down in that water and you drowned. But like the second passage says, they will not sweep over you. Why? Because he's going to reach down. He's going to pull you up out of that water. When we're raised or risen from the depths of that water, we're raised into a new life. You died down there. It's not just the idea of being in a tomb or being buried. It is certainly that. But these passages, the way the Old Testament looks at it, it is way more violent than that. And we know from Jesus' death, it is way more violent than that. We have a life that needs to go away. It must die. That's what this represents. And it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. So what does Jesus then say? He says, you don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? And what's their answer to his question? Yes, we can. I don't think they have a clue as to what he just said to them. But the answer is yes. Why is it yes? Because they want to sit on his left and right hand. He's going to be raised in glory. And man, they want to be part of that. They're thinking that's going to be cool. Don't really get this whole death stuff, but great. I want to be there. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom the Lord, for whom they have been prepared. You see, the way I put it down there at the bottom, you either look at this as a banquet feast or a suffering servant. Now we know, because we understand Isaiah, that Jesus is talking about being the suffering servant. He is the suffering servant. The apostles think they're going to a banquet feast. Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, you want to drink that cup? Give me a cup. You know, Passover, they had four cups, I think it is. I just lost that number in my head. I think it's four cups. They drank some good things. They remembered. It's a remembering how powerful the Lord brought them out of Egypt. Those are good things. That, yeah, yes, we'll participate in that with you. Of course we will, Jesus. They're not thinking in terms of the cup of wrath. Baptism, they were baptized quite frequently. Many of the devout Jews were baptized every week before they went to Sabbath. On the Day of Atonement, when they're making the sacrifices of the lambs, the high priest, before he goes into the Holy of Holies, is baptized, the way I've read it, five times that day as he changes clothes. He's baptized, changes clothes, does a part. Baptized, changes clothes, does a part. Baptized, changes clothes, does a part. So the idea of baptism wasn't this swirling, wasn't this dangerous thing. It was a thing, yes, we're becoming ritually and ceremonially holy and pure so that we can worship God. These are positive things. They're thinking, yeah, we can do all that. Yeah, we can do that. And Jesus says, you will drink the cup that I drink. He's talking about the cup of wrath. You will be baptized with the baptism I'm talking about. In other words, you're going to be into the swirling depths, and it's only going to be by the power of God that'll bring you up out of that. He says, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. I thought of something. I didn't see this in any commentaries, but it just struck me. A couple of other passages of Scripture. In Isaiah 52, see, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. In John chapter 3, Jesus is talking to Nicodemus. He's referring back to Moses lifting up the brass snake and curing the people of the snake bites. It says, so the Son of Man must be lifted up that everyone who believes may have eternal life in Him. And then I thought about in Mark, we're going to read it when we get to chapter 15, they crucified two rebels with Him, one on His right and one on His left. Now, I have no earthly idea if Jesus is talking about, I can't give you those spots because those spots are already taken. He's implied that the Father is the one who picks that and He's already taken care of who's there appointed to. The Bible doesn't specifically say that Jesus' crucifixion is His glory, but Peter is referred to as His glory being the way He's going to die for Jesus. Jesus certainly glorified God by the way He accepted the death sentence that was laid on Him, even though it wasn't due Him. He was certainly glorified when He's raised up and seated again with the Father in the right hand in heaven. But I tend to think that at this point in time, in this context, the glory of Jesus is His death on the cross and then subsequent burial and resurrection. So when you think about sitting on His left and on His right, I tend to think it's those two thieves. And Jesus says, guys, you're gonna suffer with Me. You're gonna feel the wrath of God because you're gonna need to do that for the rest of the people that you're gonna be preaching to. But sitting on My right and left, that's not what you think it is. It is not what you think it is. When the other 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Clearly, the fact that they became indignant implies something very, very simple in my mind, and that is that they thought, just like James and John, that those first two seats were good. They weren't mad at Him because they didn't understand that Jesus was going to have to die. They're mad at Him because they got to Jesus first. They wanted Jesus just to pick two of them to sit on His left and right out of the whole 12, not have these two come up and pick their spots for them. They didn't understand what Jesus had just said to James and John. Then Jesus calls them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them and that their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Have we heard Him say this before? Do you think we need to be hearing that? Jesus is saying this idea of seeking glory by wanting to be on top or ahead of everyone is not the way it works. We hear sermons on this all the time. We hear many, many sermons about Jesus and washing the feet of the disciples. But I'm sorry, in the culture we live in and the way we think, it's not the way we think. We still think that being on top is best. And Jesus says, no, you're missing it. And He ends with, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many. One more time, He's talking about His death. And now He's explaining that His life is a ransom for others. He's starting to explain how this is really going to work. Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and His disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called the blind man. Cheer up, on your feet. He's calling you. All right, now let's look at this. A couple of things that are kind of interesting here. We get this guy's name. His name is Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. There's some questions about whether Timaeus has something to do with suffering or whatever. Most of the commentators don't even mention that, so I don't think they think that's very true. One guy made a comment that I think is really interesting and probably accurate. They suspect that Bartimaeus was an active member in the church, that he remained a disciple of Jesus after this event. And they probably either knew his name or possibly even knew him, which is why maybe Mark goes out of his way to name him. Can you see, we've mentioned this same scene three or four times. Mark, we say, learned what he learned about Jesus from Peter, so this is more the gospel of Peter as written by Mark or recorded by Mark. Can you see Peter and Mark sitting around a campfire some night, and Peter is telling him these stories and telling him things, and he says, Peter, I'm talking about Bartimaeus. You know Bartimaeus. You remember Bartimaeus? You know, we had dinner with him when we were back in Jerusalem, or he was up in Antioch. You know, this is Bartimaeus. This is who I'm talking about. This is the guy. This is the guy. And he was sitting by the roadside begging. Pay attention to that phrase, by the roadside. We're going to look at that again in just a second. But he's sitting by the roadside begging. Typically in that day, when you are in Jericho, if you look up the Jericho mean temperatures, the lowest recorded, not recorded, but the lowest average temperature throughout the year is only like 40 degrees. And the highest temperature average throughout the year is the neighborhood of 70 or 80 degrees. So it is a very temperate place as far as temperature is concerned. So you don't have a whole lot of need for coats and stuff. It's pretty warm, pretty comfortable, probably a nice place. As a matter of fact, King Herod built his summer home down there, or winter home. I don't remember which one it was. Probably a winter home, because it was more comfortable than up more in the highlands where Jerusalem was. But anyway, he's sitting by the roadside. Typically, a beggar would sit there on the ground and he would have his coat laid out in front of him, and that's where people would come by when he would ask for alms and gifts for the poor. They would put a few coins or whatever into his coat, and that's how he collects it. So think about that as we're sitting there. So he hears that Jesus of Nazareth is coming by, and what does he shout? He shouts, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. What does Son of David mean? He is acknowledging that Jesus is the Messiah. That's what Son of David meant. You're on the line of David. David's the king. It's his line that's going to be held forever. Remember, we've talked about the fact that he's of Judah, and Judah was prophesied that the scepter would not leave his hand. Jesus is that. Bartimaeus has some inkling of an understanding of what that means. And he says, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And the people around him saying, shut up, be quiet. You're just a beggar. Just be quiet over there, beggar. We're trying to talk to him. We're trying to get up close to him. You just sit there where you are. But that just made him shout louder. Son of David, have mercy on me. So Jesus stops, like he has a tendency to do. When someone asks to talk to him, Jesus stops and says, okay, I'm ready to listen. And he said, call him. He tells one, okay, whoever that guy is, get that guy and bring him up over here. And they turned to him and said, okay, this is your lucky day there, Bartimaeus. Jesus has said, come on up. He's calling for you. Look at what he does. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. You see that? Throwing his cloak aside, meaning he jumped up, forget the begging, forget how much money he's collected. It doesn't matter whether it was a dime or a dollar or $100. He says, forget that. He's running to Jesus because he knows Jesus can do something for him. And Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? Have you heard that phrase before? Do you realize that when James and John go to Jesus and say, we want you to do us a favor, he says, what do you want me to do for you? Exact same phrase. Mark is very consistent in using things like that and tying stories together. So he ties these two stories together. Remember, the apostles said, Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? And they say, we want to be number one and number two in your kingdom. What does Bartimaeus say? Jesus asked him, the blind man said, Rabbi, I want to see. He says, I want to see. Mark is not saying this because we have a blind man that needs to be healed. Jesus is happy to heal the blind man. He's healed others. Remember how this whole section started over in chapter 2, chapter 8, I mean, when there's this blind man that is brought to Jesus and Jesus touches him and he only sees a little bit, he can see more than he could before, but people are like trees walking around, can't make it out. Then Jesus touches him again and then he can see clearly. And we said that double touch healing is going to play out because the apostles aren't getting it on the first touch. It's taking them multiple touches to get it because they immediately follow with a declaration that Jesus is the Messiah. That's like walking around seeing trees. Messiah is good. It's important. It's way better than being totally blind, but they don't get it because Peter immediately doesn't understand the prophecies, Jesus' prophecy of his own death and crucifixion and resurrection. Bartimaeus says, I want to see. I just want to see. Go, said Jesus. Your faith has healed you. We've been through this over and over and over again. Jesus is referring to faith. It's either the faith of someone they're bringing him, it's the faith of the person themselves, or it's Jesus' own faith in order, Jesus' own actions in order to increase the faith of his apostles, where the person didn't have anything to do with it. See, it's not talking, we've said this many, many times, it's not talking about you have to have the right amount of faith. And that right amount of faith, if you have too little faith, Jesus won't heal you. Enough faith, Jesus will. More faith, you can cast mountains into the sea. That's not, I'm going to say it one more time, that's not what he's talking about here. He's not talking about how much faith you have. He's talking about in whom you have faith. Do you have faith in Jesus? Remember when we talked about the rich young ruler? We said that rich young ruler put his faith in his money, in his prestige, in his position, his power. The apostles were putting their faith in the prestige and position that they were going to have. They wanted to know who's going to be the greatest, which one of them, not Jesus. And they want to know, will you set us in your first, on your left and right side? And Jesus has multiple times said, first is last, last is first. You're not getting the math. The math is simple, not common, not easy to understand, but it's simple. This guy has faith that when Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? He says, I want to see. And Jesus said, your faith has healed you. Immediately, he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. See, the implication here is that he just left that coat, he left his old life, he left begging, he can now see, and what does he do? He doesn't run back and go get a job down at the local Walmart. He doesn't go back and try to rebuild his life from the point at which he went blind. We don't know whether it was from birth or been a long time. He says, I want to see, and he immediately follows Jesus. One of the things that I want you to remember when Jesus is talking about the people, why he uses parables, because he said, I want to make sure that they see, so I speak in parables, because they may not see. Sometimes you're just blind and you can't get it, even though it's right there in front of you, you should be able to get it, you're just blind and you don't get it. This guy gets it. I also like the way the ESV and the King James Version translate along the road. It's along the way. You remember in Acts when we talk about what the church is called there? They were called the way. And this time, remember before we said that Bartimaeus was sitting along the road? I'm sorry, beside the road. Now he is on the road. He's not just sitting in one spot watching the road go past him. He's on the road. He's on his way to Jerusalem. He's following Jesus. Jesus is leading the way, and he is going to be part of that. Now, I don't know whether he literally stayed as part of that or not, but I like the thought. Jesus is trying to say to his apostles, this blind guy gets it. Why can't you? Remember how Jesus said to him at one point, he says, how long do I have to put up with you? Talking to those apostles, how long? I don't have much more time. It's now days. We're talking days. And Jesus is going, you still are worried about being the greatest in the kingdom. You still don't get it. They'll get it, but it's going to take a little bit while, a little bit longer. Let me ask you a question. Are you following Jesus along the way? Are you? Have you left your coat on the side of the road? Are you still the rich young ruler? Are you still the apostles wanting to know whether you're greatest? Have I done everything I need to know? Remember what the rich young ruler said? Hey, am I going to be there in the second age, in the age to come? Am I going to be one of the ones that are there? Do I make it? Do I get it? Jesus doesn't want us to worry about those things. He wants us to know that if we're following Him, we're in. We're there. It doesn't matter how much you're doing, what exactly you're doing. Jesus is going to have things for you to do. Remember, in Ephesians chapter 2, it says that there are works for you that have been prepared well in advance. That ain't how you get in. You got work you're going to do. That work, I'm going to give you the job to do. You don't get in by that. You get in by the grace of God and by faith in me, which is exactly what the grace of God's all about. Are you along the road? Are you on that road? Are you walking? Are you behind Jesus? Is that dust coming up on your... I sure hope so. Have a great week. Next week, we're going to see Jesus enter Jerusalem in a very triumphal way. It's going to be exciting. Have a great week. God bless you.